Three initials can communicate a lot. We'll focus on I, C, and U together. The intensive care unit at the hospital, any ICU in any hospital, is not a place people want to be. They get there because their health is greatly impacted and they need extra care and attention from medical staff. For families of patients, it can be a truly frightening place. Someone you care about is hooked up to lots of machines and your time with the patient can be very limited. Dr. Lara Goitein wrote a book to help people get their bearings in that situation. It's called The ICU Guide for Families, Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. Dr. Lara Goitein is an MD specializing in pulmonary and critical care medicine. She has 12 years experience in ICUs. Dr. Goitein, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jeff, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. The ICU, as I can relate, is a very scary place for patients and families. What is it like from your side, though?
Well, the ICU is certainly a very intense, trying place to work. You know, a large fraction of your patients are very sick, and some of them will die. So that's obviously very intense, but it's also extremely rewarding. You have the opportunity routinely to save people's lives. And I'll also say that there's nothing quite like the ICU in terms of stripping away the superficial. You are profoundly central and important, and you get to participate in what are some of the most intense and pivotal times in a patient's life. You may never speak to that patient, possibly, if they're unconscious or too sick to really communicate with you. But nevertheless, you get to know them extremely well. Some of the most important and private things about them is you work with families to make decisions for them. And the superficial just sort of drops away, and you're right in the heart of what matters. There's nothing quite like that experience.
Oh, I see your point about the superficial dropping away. You really have to get into some serious conversations with people about healthcare and where things go.
That's right. And also, in some cases, as you're discussing how aggressive to be and end-of-life care, you're getting really into very personal values about the meaning of a good life, a good death. Does the person believe in God? Are they afraid of being dependent or helpless? And these are very intimate moments with patients and really a privilege.
So take us to square one, Dr. Goitein. Why do people end up in the ICU? What is it primarily for?
People may end up in the ICU for many different reasons. So pneumonia, appendicitis, trauma, drug overdoses. There are many primary causes or causes that will bring people to the ICU. Generally, people are in the ICU because they require very close monitoring and aggressive treatment and very high staff-to-patient ratios so that they can be watched very closely and a lot of resources can be brought to bear. So the reasons that people come into the ICU are very diverse. Once they're there, there are certain patterns and conditions common to many patients in the ICU that come with many reasons for being very sick that we see and treat over and over again. But the initial reasons for coming are very, very diffuse, and people have very variable courses depending on what those reasons are. Some people are there for very short ICU stays and bounce back quite quickly. Some have prolonged stays, possibly require prolonged life support, and those patients, unfortunately, may live with the effects of an ICU mission for months or even years to come after discharge.
All right, so, but I'm glad you brought up some of the fates here because it is not a one-way thing. You don't go into the ICU and never come out.
No, absolutely not. In fact, the large majority of ICU patients survive and get better. And then there are, of course, the minority who we may lose or who may have very prolonged, difficult courses.
We're talking to Dr. Laura Goitein on the Jefferson Exchange about her book, The ICU Guide for Families, Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. Maybe you've had this experience or fear having it. Join us on the Exchange with your questions, your comments at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. There's a reminder in here for all of us to make our wishes known in advance. If we do not, what are our families likely to face in the ICU in the way of having to make some decisions for us and about us?
So many family members, as more and more time passes and perhaps their loved one is not getting better, begin to worry that a prolonged ICU stay would not be in accordance with their loved one's wishes. The truth is that we can keep almost anyone technically alive. We have medications and machines to support the function of the heart and blood pressure. We have machines to support your breathing. We have machines to support the function of your kidneys. So we can keep people alive sometimes past the point where they could return to a reasonable quality of life, and that's not somewhat something that anyone would want. A lot of patients, when they first think, when is enough enough, feel really monstrous and guilty. But decisions about withdrawing life support are very common. So 65% of all of the deaths that happen in the ICU happen because patients, families, and doctors work together and come to the decision that it's time to withdraw life-supporting treatment. So these decisions are far from monstrous. They are loving and necessary and quite common. At some point, the question becomes not whether you will live or die, but how you will die and when. So the job of a family member is to represent what they think that patient's wishes would be, not what their wishes are. And that's a key distinction. I think a lot of family members feel a terrible burden and sense of responsibility in helping to make these decisions. But really your job, being the person who knows the patient best, is to represent what you feel they would want based on all of your discussions, your knowledge of their values, and hopefully an advanced directive that's very, very helpful.
There are several levels of approach you mention here to life-saving measures. You advocate full code in the first 24 hours. What is that and why?
I do, with some exceptions. If a case is clearly hopeless, if the patient has an advanced directive saying that they would not want a code, certainly. In cases of very severe or terminal underlying illness, then a code doesn't make sense. So let me back up and explain a code. Mm-hmm. A code is really cardiopulmonary resuscitation, where measures are taken to restart the heart's function or to put a patient on mechanical ventilation so that they are able to breathe. Most ICUs have policies where they ask everyone who comes in what they would want the code status to be. Now, some families are confused by that question. They say, well, you know, why not try to restart the heart or lungs? And the reason is that requiring cardiopulmonary resuscitation in itself tells you that the patient is extremely sick, tells you something about the prognosis, and the resuscitation itself is a prolonged period of time where the body really is not getting optimal blood flow and oxygen. And so the risk is that the person may come back with a very poor prognosis, or at worst, some sort of underlying organ damage, including injury to the brain, and not be quite the person that they were. For some patients, it just doesn't make sense to take those risks, and I mentioned a few cases in which that would be so. barring those sorts of reasons, though, in general, I do support making a patient full code, meaning all of these measures would be taken initially. There's a lot of prognostic information that will come back in the first day or two as people start to figure out what brought the patient to the ICU, and as you start to see whether the patient is beginning to turn the corner with treatment. The decision to have a patient be full code, which means that all these measures would be taken, can always be reversed, and life-supporting treatment can always be withdrawn while keeping the patient completely comfortable if decision should change. So, barring a clear reason to not make a patient full code, in general, I would advise families who are overwhelmed by this question and may not even have a clear sense of what's going on with their loved one yet, to go with full code, and other decisions can be made with the fullness of time and reflection as you go forward.
Laura Goitein, MD, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She wrote the ICU Guide for Families, Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. So when you get to see a loved one in ICU, it can be a little scary because, you know, tubes, wires, all that stuff, they may not be conscious. So you need to see the person under the tubes and wires, as you advocate in the book. How do you communicate that to the medical staff, though, to say, hey, look, I know this person?
Well, that's a very good question. When people first enter the room of an ICU patient for this first time, they're likely to be overwhelmed by a mass of equipment and tubes and wires. Depending on how sick they are, their family member may look very different. First of all, he or she may appear to be sleeping or unconscious, and there may be a lot of edema or swelling, some bruising. So it can be quite intimidating and overwhelming and upsetting. And I think it's important to not be alienated by those factors and to go right up and approach the bedside. You belong right next to your family member. Ask the nurse if you may pull up a chair. You can always move if there's something immediate that the nurse needs to do and you're in the way. And take your family member's hand. You are, all of the tubes and wires should be pretty well secured, so you're unlikely to damage anything or accidentally dislodge something. Take their hand, sit with them, and talk with them, and pretend they're conscious. Pretend they can hear everything you say. We don't know quite what patients can hear and understand, and it's best to assume that they need to hear your voice and explain to them where they are and provide orientation to the patient.
Okay, now, so that's talking to the patient. Now, talking to the medical staff, I mean, of all the array of people who are dealing with a patient's care, who is supposed to talk to family members? How often can they do so? And is it often enough for the family members?
Right. ICU care is so complex that it really requires a large, multidisciplinary team to take care of patients. And often, people are very confused. Who are all these people rushing around? You should know that there is one person in charge of the patient and the team, and that is the ICU doctor. In an academic teaching hospital where there are medical students and residents, that person will be called the attending physician in the ICU. And that person really does have responsibility for overseeing and coordinating the patient's care with that huge team of people who are involved. The bedside nurse will be present for most of the day. He or she likely has only one or maybe two other patients. This is at baseline. Of course, COVID is really stressing our system and increasing those nurse-to-patient ratios. But in general, your nurse should be present at the bedside for much of the day and is an excellent source of information. ICU nurses are really expert professionals and can give you a lot of information. It's also important to talk to the doctor. That can be a real challenge. ICU doctors may be taking care of, you know, 15 to 30 patients. And this is, again, at baseline, not during the pandemic. They, depending on the day, depending on how sick their patients are and who's coming into the ICU, they will range from busy to frantically busy. So the other important thing to realize is that their schedules are very variable. It depends with their patients at any given minute. So it's hard to pin them down to set times to communicate. What I would recommend is that you give the physician a range of time. Generally, the afternoons or even evenings are... they're at the bedside or in the waiting room or by phone between the hours of, say, 2 and 5 p.m. I would really like a chance to talk to you somewhere in there. And giving some flexibility increases your chances of having a meaningful conversation. I should say that doctors are extremely aware of the need to speak with you. They want to speak with you. They want to give you explanations. It's just sometimes very difficult, depending on what else is happening in the ICU, to schedule a time to do that. But you should expect to communicate regularly with your physician. When your loved one is unstable or very sick or things are changing rapidly, possibly every few hours, when your loved one has stabilized, perhaps you've been in ICU for a while, maybe every day or so. But you should have that expectation, and it's important that you have those conversations with the doctor. So don't feel bad about pestering busy doctors. That's important, and they know that.
Dr. Lara Goitein, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a physician herself, 12 years experience in ICUs. She's written the ICU Guide for Families, Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. I was a little surprised to see that there's information here about if you're not getting the kinds of answers you want, to consider having your patient move to another hospital. Is that even possible in a majority of cases?
It is, and probably about 1 in 20 ICU patients will be transferred for one reason or another, because they need a different level of care or because of a family member's request. It's also important to realize that there are some risks of transfer. So about 1 in 15 patients will have some sort of adverse event during their transfer. There's the physical difficulty of moving and transporting very sick patients with lots of equipment and tubes in place. There's the risk of dislodging them. And maybe even more important, it provides room for poor communication and transfers of care where errors can happen. So it's not something to be done lightly. I think most people assume that perhaps their loved one would be better off in a very famous, big academic medical center or specialized center, and that is probably true for certain patients with rare illnesses or who require very specialized procedures. But most hospitals, most good community hospitals, are able to provide gold standard care for most ICU conditions, and in some cases can do that in a less rushed and more personal atmosphere. So there are certainly cases where transfer is appropriate, but it's something to be thought through carefully, and it's not automatically something to consider, for sure.
Okay, but so we're down to our last 2 minutes or so here, Laura, and I want to hit on a major point for the families of people in the ICU, which is, okay, so you've been seeing to your loved ones' health and maintenance and care. How about taking care of yourself? What are some of the steps there to make sure that that you as a family member keep alert, keep a clear head, all that stuff?
Absolutely. Family members suffer a lot in the ICU. It is a very stressful, difficult experience. Many family members leave the ICU with some mental health residual, some post-traumatic stress disorder, or some depression. So it's unquestionably a very hard experience. I think, you know, for the first 24 hours, a lot of people are so absorbed in what's going on with their loved one, they forget to eat or go to the bathroom or get any fresh air. It's important to see this really as a marathon, not a sprint, and to try to take care of yourself. Your family and friends are a resource. They will want to help, and they won't be sure how. So asking them to do things like spell you in the ICU while you go out and get some fresh air, maybe bring you a meal, maybe take a walk with you, these are things that they will like and want to do. And just paying attention to your own needs, eating fresh air, getting some sleep. You need to preserve your strength so that if your family member is there for more than a very short admission, you have the stamina to be there for them and make good decisions on their behalf. You know, I think that although the stressors of the experience are obvious and their negative effects very well documented, there's another side of the story that isn't as well told. And that is the amazing things that come from people at the moments when we're most tested.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We'll have to stop there, though. I'm sorry, because we're just out of time.
Yes.
But yeah, an excellent point there that good does come out of the ICU and people do survive.
Absolutely.
And so, all right, a lot to learn here, but it's a helpful guide. Dr. Laura Goitein is the author of the ICU Guide for Families: Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. Laura, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You bet.